Hi, I'm Sharon Barker. I'm an alcoholic. Well, I was going to comment on everybody leaving, but oh well. I was going to comment on the corsage too, but it's like, you know, I drank because I had these little nubs, and well, you know, I always ask for the wrist corsage, you know, because I had nice shoulders. So, but we're holding them up tonight, girls. So thank you all for having me. I'd like to thank Dave very much, and Reed and the committee, and Glenn and Ray and everybody that had anything to do with me being here. And there's a legacy of Alcoholics Anonymous in this room tonight, right down from Glenn, who was the top, right down to 21 days to 5 days and everybody in between. And I know when we got to 11 years, I'm going, yes, they made it from 10 to 11, because I remember it was a tough year in my life. And I just feel very connected with all of you. And there's a couple of women in here that I sponsor, and the people they sponsor. And it just makes me feel safe. And that was something I hadn't felt for an awful long time until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was looking, you know how sometimes your mind kind of hits on something you haven't thought of, and maybe, well, in my case, about 25 years, and that's kind of scary. I thought that it was in the Swiss cheese gone, but I looked at that TV box tonight that you're having for your raffle. Hopefully there's a TV in it. That was my next thought. I remember being drunk out of my mind in Shreveport, Louisiana, down in a bee drinking club, selling an empty box to somebody, and with the getaway car ready to go, and I haven't thought of that in a long time. Long time. And, you know, I mean, that was just one of the many escapades of getting another drink, you know, getting some more drinking money so that I could further my story for Alcoholics Anonymous, I guess. If I would have known I was coming here, I probably would have taken better notes. But I was just in New Orleans last weekend, and one of my old roommates, who's now sober 12 years, was reaffirming some of my story. And yeah, it was like the alcoholics in the French Quarter would look at me and go, if we ever get as bad as Cher, you know, boy, I don't know, you're going to have to do something. Who's keeping her tonight? She's passed out alone over there again. Who's watching her? And, you know, I got to walk that French Quarter last Sunday night and go see some sober friends and be with some sober people, and just, you know, it makes the hair on my arms stand up just to go, whew, seconds and inches, boy. You know, saw this girl walking to work, and Casey was with me, and he said, hey, looks like you maybe walking to work 20 years ago or 22 years ago. And, you know, her roots were showing, and she had this nice little outfit with zippers everywhere, and she didn't have the fishnet stocking or platform shoes on. I broke a lot of bones on those platform shoes in that French Quarter streets, but you know, as she was walking, she looked like she had business. She was business as usual, walking down Bourbon Street to work. And, you know, I thought, yeah, you know, I know where she's coming from and I know where she's going, but where's the pet skunk? She didn't have the pet skunk, you know, and that's just kind of how I lived, you know. Well, the skunk liked to drink. He was my friend. You know, he used to go to this club, and he liked rum and coke. And so he would, you know, he'd drink his rum and coke and end up on his back, and then I would drink my tequila and end up next to the skunk, and then I would hear out of the corner of my ear, buy the skunk down there a drink, and, you know, somebody would go, which one, you know, and it's, and, you know, tonight I stand before you, from the tip of my head to the tip of my toes, feeling like a complete human being and one of God's kids. Now, how do you get from there to here? How do you, you know, it's an inside job. Oh, it's outside too, but it's also an inside job. And you know, I was an empty, lonely, desperate, you know, bewildered, terrorized human being. And I had no idea it was alcoholism. And, you know, within a stone's throw of this room tonight are probably a few people that are alcoholics. You know, the odds are. And, you know, it's just, they may never know. They may never know that there is a place for them to come. There's a place for them to feel safe, to know that just, God, you know, that there are miracles that happen every single day of our life, and we get a second chance, and I'm really grateful to know that. It allows me to feel like I have a purpose in life, and I always wanted that. You know, I grew up in Iowa, and it was like, oh, my first resentment. I mean, where do you landlocked state. And, you know, I read those teen magazines in 17 and all that, and I thought, what am I doing here? Where is, you know, the mothership? And I was obsessed with UFOs as a child. I went out looking for the mothership. My first term paper was on UFOs. I dug up everything there was about UFOs and looking for the mothership because I knew they were coming back. And you know what? I'm the alcoholic in my family. There is nobody else that's falling out of the closet, or there's no skeletons rattling around that I can find. You know, and so they're real grateful we know what's wrong with me now. Real grateful. Because I confused them. You know, I started getting those looks in my mom and dad's eyes early on. Like, oh, you know, before I even took a drink, what are you saying or what are you thinking? I told Mary Kroll, my best friend, my secret thoughts one night as we were camping out, you know, under the stars. And I thought, what's a good time to kind of test it? She didn't talk to me for 2 years. I mean, that's how odd I was. It's a class conference, so they give me a bottle. Right at home. I knew that there was something just a little bit off in me, and I didn't know who to talk to about that. And I had a nice upbringing, and you know, I was in and out of that confessional in 30 seconds, because if you were in longer than that, you were a bad girl. And so I used to categorize everything, and somebody else over there too. I learned how to manipulate early, how to look good early, how to keep that smoke screen going. I was active, I was participating, I played the accordion, for God's sake. I mean, and saxophone and piano was cool, but not the accordion. But my dad, you know, was Czechoslovakian. I thought this is, you know, he seemed to kind of, I didn't get enough attention from my father. So I would play this accordion, and occasionally we would have to play for these centennials of these towns that would have the big celebration, and they put you on a hay wagon, and we'd wear all these matching red dresses, and they would, you know, you had to fold them out just so over the bale of hay you're sitting on, and my big Titano accordion and patent leather shoes, and, you know, Miss Broderick up there leading us as we're going down on this hay wagon down the middle of town. And I would see somebody I had drank with the night before, you know, and it was like, you know, it was those two worlds would collide, you know, and I'd try to move over so that they wouldn't see me up there playing this accordion and being Miss America, you know. And then I'd see my father, and I'd be really proud and play it real loud for him. And you know, I just got to be a little bit of work doing that kind of thing. You know, when the 60s hit, the late 60s, I went off to college, and it wasn't just the alcohol anymore. It wasn't the just say no generation like, you know, it was in the 80s. It was just say thanks. And, you know, we took a lot of stuff with our alcohol. And, you know, and I was quick to find those things that made you quick. And, you know, you could study and you could stay up all night and you could find truth. And then the psychedelics were out and I was looking for truth and I would find truth. And, you know, but it would melt before you could write it down or, you know. It was on that album somewhere, Satanic Majesty's Request. Yeah, there it was. And then, where is it? And I was like really beginning to get frantic looking for truth. And I had a, you know, fake ID, and I was in Joe's place in the airliner, and I was the pledge trainer, and I would meet all the pledges in the bar, and the actors began to frown on that and frown on the way I was starting to dress. And we just, you know, we had this political convention in Chicago, and I was there in 68. I went there with the sole intention of, campaigning for this peace candidate, and I had my sorority clothes on with my pin, and I stood next to a movie star. We wore the little hats, you know, those convention hats, and, you know, I remember I had my matching patent leather bag with shoes and Bobby Brooks matching clothes and white gloves, and I was passing out these leaflets, and, you know, I had full clearance at this hotel, and by the end of that convention, there was something calling me. You know, his name was Dick Gregory. I was following him to Mayor Daley's house and smoking pot in one hand and, you know, drinking my wine in the other, and, you know, is it the peace sign or the one finger? I could never quite get it right, you know. And I left that sorority, and I made a big deal about it, and we moved off campus, and I started taking art classes, and I started waking my parents up in the middle of the night to introduce them to my newfound friends. And I remember the night I woke them up to tell them I changed my name. That was a big one, you know, at 2 a.m. And, you know, my dad just set that jaw. He was real good at setting that jaw. And my mother would just go, "Oh, Sharon," you know, and go off to bed. And, you know, and I remember I changed it to Cher. And they thought, you know, S-H-A-R-E, you know, not like Cher, Sonny and Cher. It was like Cher and Cher like Dad, you know, and he liked that one, I'll tell you. And So anytime my phone rings and I hear the word Cher, I go, oh, God, you know, and somebody from the past. And but my father's beginning to worry, and I had the suicide attempt because I was just depressed. I woke up one morning, and this guy was laying on all my albums. And, you know, Janis Joplin, you know, he's like scratching, he's passed out, and his straggly hair and his dirty feet and, you know, a couple of cigarette burns in one of them. And I was just like, I went in the bathroom and started cutting my wrists. That was my answer. I just had no answers. And, you know, my roommate came in, and then I wrote my dad this letter, and so he brought the priest down, and they tried to talk to me. And the priest and I got drunk that night, and, you know, I went to priests a lot looking for answers, you know, because I like to debate with them, you know. I like to really put them on the line and push them a little over the edge. And I don't know, I think I was 19 years old, and I was in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, having a debate in the confessional with this priest, where he came around the confessional, and we had this screaming fight, and I left the church, chafing in my fist, saying, screw you and screw your God. And that was it, you know. That was a way that I could just start to shake my fist and turn my back on anything that was there in my life, you know, because I began to look at everything like it was hypocritical. I began to be angry. I had my heart broken by this man that I was going to marry, and pulled a window shade on that feeling, a big, big, giant window shade on that feeling. I remember my mother looking at me and saying, aren't you going to cry? And I said, no. And I pulled the window shade on that feeling. And I came in here with a lot of those kind of feelings shoved in this Pandora's box. And in Alcoholics Anonymous, they start beating on those doors, you know, and the steps and the people. And eventually you get a sponsor and they walk around that dark room and start flicking up window shades, you know. And thank God you got somebody you can trust, because it's like Dracula seeing light for the first time. It was painful. I went through a lot. I shoved those feelings and that pain and my disappointments and my heartaches and my hopes and my dreams. I just shoved them somewhere and poured alcohol on them, you know, and that kept them quiet, you know. That kept those things quiet. My head was always loud, and I love to get everybody up in my head drunk. When we all got drunk, we had a great time. And I love to get them all drunk up there. I like to just not feel that guilt, not feel that pain, not feel that envy. All, you know, I just love to pour alcohol on it because it worked. It worked for me. And, you know, if it still worked, I'd be at that bar tonight with that Jose Cuervo Gold, you know, because I was up in my room before I came. And I remember this priest, his name's Father Bill, I think he's San Diego, and he talks about drinking the martini and how it sounds and what it looks like and how it smells. And he made me thirsty, you know. He started talking about this martini. Sorry. And I was laying in bed maybe a couple of weeks later, and this man up the block about 4 a.m. started his Harley and woke me up. And I thought, ah, that's what tequila was like. Kick-starting a Harley, you know. It was just room, you know. It did it for me right away. I am not into long-term comfort. Give me instant gratification, you know. That's why I like things that made me fast and furious. And let's go to the edge. Okay, let's hang 10. Who made it? You go to, we came back today. Somebody fell over the edge. Too bad, you know. It just began to be along with my life, that kind of isolation from the human race, that kind of self-motivated, selfish, self-centered being. And that was Alcoholics Anonymous. A true gentleman. And his name is Wes, which is my son's name. Brings me a cup. Thank you. And I just, you know, I was lost, and I never knew it. And I started taking geographics, and I didn't know that I was looking for, you know, the answer somewhere else. It just, it seemed to be the natural thing to do. I mean, I was not encumbered with a husband or children or any of that. And I could just go. And, you know, my dad and I had one more fight one more time. And, you know, that art professor was telling me things that I didn't want to hear because he wanted me to do some work. I was being a little too creative. It was, you know, I was laying on canvases. I put paint on my body and lay, you know. And he didn't understand I was the new Jackson Pollock, you know. He didn't get it. And he wanted me to be more structured. And so I shook my fist and I went off to New York looking for the greener grass. And I came to Alcoholics Anonymous to find out why the grass was greener. You know, piece of truth I looked for my whole life. I come to Alcoholics Anonymous and Norm Alpe. Norm said the reason the grass was greener, kid, is because the other guy took care of his lawn. It was like, oh, got it, you know? But being a good old-timer, they don't give you truth without hope. You know, he said, if you are new, you got some good fertilizer. We're going to make a good lawn. So hang in there. We're going to till that stuff up. But I did that. You know, I went from place to place, and it got more frantic and more crazy. And by the time I was 20 years old, I was depressed. My life was over, and I called my dad. One more time, Dad, let me go to college. I'm serious now. I mean it. And so he gave me one more chance. And I went to those art classes, and I sat there in front of an empty canvas with an empty soul, and I couldn't create. And I didn't know what was wrong. I didn't know it was part of what I was giving up for my alcoholism. I had no idea that somewhere sitting in New York, when I was living there for 10 months, that bartender, you know, maybe he would have said, you know, if you drink this tonight and act that way, that's the last of your creativity. You're going to go into a 25-year slump. I would have said, double it and back it up and, you know, buy them one too. You know, I gave up pieces of my soul for my alcoholism and had no choice. Had no choice. Alcohol was more powerful, king alcohol, more powerful than anything in my life. And I went into a 25-year creative slump after that. And I ended up in Colorado where I met Bob Dylan. And I think it was Bob Dylan. And I came to You know what? Actually, I don't tell this story very much, but Casey and I went to a concert about 4 years ago, and we just happened to get fourth row seats. I don't know what happened, and they put us in the fourth row. It was a Bob Dylan concert. At the end of the show, the encore, they let the first four rows go and stand at his feet, you know. So there I am, Bob Dylan's feet, again, I'm thinking. And right at the end of right before the lights went out, he pointed at me and smiled. And everybody's going, oh, God, he pointed at you. What does it mean, you know? And Casey said, it was Bob Dylan, you know. Yeah, it was him. And so we came to California, and I ended up at a commune, and I don't know where Bob went, but I lived at this commune, and I panhandled and tried to panhandle. You have no self-worth. You don't make money, so they end up putting you in the kitchen where we, you know, we have a lot of money. We're making a lot of chicken cacciatore with everything in it, and you don't throw away the seeds and stems. It goes in the chicken cacciatore, and, you know, you're drinking the bong wine because you don't have any money to go buy new wine, and but I was alive. I was alive. This was great. I was in California, and you know, and I turned 21 dancing with the Krishnas, and they liked me. You know, they wanted me. There was something very brown about my aura. I think they kind of, you know, they spotted it, and they wanted me. And, you know, I liked the spark they had. I've been around a lot of people that have that spark, other, you know, religions and other organizations, and I knew I desperately needed what they had. I knew that. You know, instinctively I was drawn to it, but as soon as they said eternity or forever, I would just have to pick up my backpack and leave because I did a day at a time. You know, and that's what I had to do that night of my 21st birthday with the Krishnas. I just did a day at a time and I have to go. And ended up back in Colorado where I couldn't get my things back because I never asked because I had no self-worth and somebody was wearing my clothes, using my things, living in my cabin. And I remember the screen door slamming behind me, and I thought, go back and get your things. Ask for them. They're yours. And I couldn't do it. I couldn't do it. And I remember that moment. You know, I'm glad I had the conscious moment to look back and remember how I felt about myself, which was nothing. I felt that I was nothing. And I was 21, and I should have had the world by the tail. I was one of those potential kids. I was one of those kids I could be whatever I wanted to be when I grew up. And, you know, I always wanted to be a truck driver. That's really, truly what I wanted to be, was to drive coast to coast, a truck driver. And, you know, I didn't have a lot of high potentials after I wanted to be a nun, and once that was shot, that was gone. But I was, there I was, 21, and there was no more potential. I wasn't sitting around thinking about my hopes and dreams and what I was going to be when I grew up. It was just, it was heavy. My alcoholism was heavy, and it was dark, and I ended up at the Mountain Man Bar, and I ended up back with my mom and dad, and my dad and I can't sit at the table. My mom said, you know, you can live here, just don't upset the family, don't take any drugs. And so I drank alcohol, you know, I drank alcohol, and I was very sad. I would sit in those taverns in that small town in Iowa and judge all of you. Billy Lang, look at him in here every night. I knew he'd be a loser, you know. And I'm in there every night judging him, not getting it at all. And, you know, one day I was sitting in there, and a guy that I'd gone to high school walked in, and he looked different, you know. And he said, let me take care of you. And it was like music to my ears. I had been very ill. I had gone to some psychiatrists. I had gone to doctors. They had put me on Valium. They had tried to help me out. I didn't know that I had a non-functional gallbladder. I didn't know. I was very sick and very toxic, and I had pancreatitis. And nobody knew to look for alcoholism in Iowa when I was 21. They just didn't. They absolutely had no idea. There was no history in my family. It was a nice family. It was nobody knew to look, you know. Now they're very educated, you know. When I go home after a couple of days of maybe pacing about the second day, my dad will say, isn't it time to go to one of those meetings? You know, they really like it when I come home from one of those meetings. I'm a lot calmer and life is good and I can sit in the chair and, you know, converse with them. And but nobody knew it back then. And this guy said he'd take care of me, and I had no idea. I thought I was going away for a rest to this organic farm. But they work on farms. You know, I come from a farming state. You think I get it. But, you know, we shoveled sheep dung. And, you know, and I'm still sick. And we're doing Adele Davis, and we're eating organic food, and we're making me healthy, and we're not smoking cigarettes anymore. We're smoking organic pot from morning to night. That's what we smoked, organic pot. You know, no caffeine. Everything was natural. And I'm still sick, and so they took me to the doctor, and the doctor did some tests, and he had to redo the tests. And when they came back that I had this, you know, problem internally, he said, you know, do you abuse drugs or alcohol? And I remember looking at him saying, I'm organic. You know, it was as honest as I could be. Maybe somebody would have spotted it. And as honest as I could be, because I'm incapable of being honest with myself. I can manipulate, maneuver. I fool myself. I'm so good at it. You know, without the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, without a spiritual guide, without a sponsor, without a God that loves me more than I can ever love myself, I am incapable of being honest with myself. I need to stay centered and focused in my life to know where I'm going and what I'm supposed to be doing and to have my purpose. And the way I do that is to try to stay cleaned out. You know, try to stay cleaned out all the time with the amends and, you know, with trying to walk like I talk when nobody's looking, you know, and that kind of thing. Because I can manipulate myself. I'm so good at it. I'm so good at justification. You know, it talks about justified anger. I was so good at that. I cannot afford myself that luxury. And I ended up at this organic farm with these people, and every once in a while I just would look at this organic wine we were drinking, which was a tiny, I don't even think it was a half pint. I don't know what it was, but it was small. You know, it made me thirsty looking at it. I'd go off and get really drunk, and they'd have, you know, why do you have to act like that? You know, they'd say, can't you just smoke these? You know, they weren't alcoholics. And, you know, the cat, the dog, and I would party. We'd have a good time, and, you know, I didn't care how heavy the snow was or how many notes he'd miss on his banjo with his learn to play the banjo with Pete Seeger record. He played over and over and over again. When I was drunk, I could care less. And, you know, that pot just didn't do it, that organic pot. I had to get drunk. And one night he looked at me. He gave me that look that people were giving me occasionally. And my head said loud and clear, alcohol is more fun than you. Next. I mean, it's just the way it was. It took me a while to move along, but eventually they blackballed me. They went off and did primal therapy. I didn't want to pay the money. And I wanted to go scream at the sheep and get drunk, and that's what I did. And I had my organic pot, which is a half acre of 12 foot tall, wonderful, beautiful. Oh, you know, it was heaven. That's what I did. I harvested and, you know, picked back and spent my whole summer out there in that pot patch with my wine bottle. And I was alone, and I let the hair on my legs and everywhere else grow. And I was just, Clarence the farmer was my friend, and he'd bring the booze at night, the hard stuff. And he was on his tractor because his license had been pulled for too many DWIs. And some nights he put in his teeth, some nights he wouldn't put in his teeth, but I didn't care, you know. It was like... And then I think his wife went to Al-Anon, took away the keys to the tractor, so he stopped coming. And winter was coming, I felt the cold snap. It's northern Wisconsin, I'm never going to be that cold again, I told myself, ever. And I thought, I got to get out of town. I don't know where I'm going, but I harvested this pot, horseback, 3 days. You know, the wood stove is gone, the roots are in the boiling water, and that's hanging upside down in the machine shed, and we were busy for 3 days. And I went to Menominee, Wisconsin, which was a big town. It was a college town, and I had pre-set up this dope deal so I could sell it and get out of there. And I forgot the dope. I mean, I just left it back in hefty bags. And I turned around, and two blocks behind me, there was the Ferris wheel, the lights of the merry-go-round, and I thought, Always wanted to be a gypsy. I mean, just like that. And I joined that carnival that night, and I ran a shooting gallery and left town. And, you know, my dog, the pot, and my son painted on the hood of my car and bald tires. And, you know, this car was named Cheshire. You have to name them. They last longer. It had a big grin on its grill. And, you know, it just, we should have written bust me on the side, you know. But we just ran this, and I ran with the carnies. And they were fast and furious. They liked to get drunk, and they liked to be up all night. And I got my tequila under my joint, and my dog, that's this beautiful, friendly dog, started to even snarl and growl at people, you know. And this is great, you know. I had those cowboy boots on, and I'm living out of a backpack, and screw them all, you know. And it was in town for 3 days and out of town. I loved it. You know, I always thought that I left that stuff behind me. Little did I know I was going to come to Alcoholics Anonymous and have to make amends for these kind of behaviors. And how do I go back to, you know, Arkansas and you know, Monroe, Louisiana, and places like that, and other places I don't even remember, make amends for this, you know, shooting gallery where I ripped off children? I mean, I wasn't proud of that. And later on down the road in my life, I mean, God presents opportunities. It talks about it if you're willing. You know, if you're willing, God will present the opportunity. And my son started going to a Catholic school because he was kicked out of a Lutheran school. And, you know, I was sponsoring a nun, and, you know, I was sober a few years. And so this Catholic school has this carnival every year. And guess what? Guess who works that carnival every year? Guess who goes out and buys ride tickets for total strangers? The word is out, though. Every year the clump of children now gets bigger, you know. Here she comes, you know. Every year they wait for me. I'm kind of history now at St. Augustine's Carnival, the lady that buys us ride tickets. And so I'm, you know, perpetually making my amends for that, you know, along the way. And it makes me feel good. It makes me feel clean. It makes me feel part of the, you know, part of the force for good. You know, but it was an insane life, and I met this guy that had the skunk and, you know, my dog, and we loved each other for 2 weeks and had 2 years of insanity after that. And it was, you know, the skunk would bite the dog would bite the skunk, you know, I'd bite the skunk, you know, it was insanity, and it was 2 years of this craziness. And I didn't grow up with, my parents are married 55 years. They love each other. They care about each other. I didn't grow up with people hurting each other, and this was a normal thing for me to grow right into in my life. You know, it was another piece of my soul taken away one night somewhere. You know, my dignity gone. You know, my innocence gone. You know, that was gone, and it was so natural for it to be gone on this road of alcoholism. And, you know, we got busted for drugs and thrown in jail in Bogalusa, Louisiana. It was a felony. I had enough stuff for sales and possession, which made it a felony, and it was maximum security lockup, and it wasn't very nice, and it wasn't very pretty. And after about a week in there, they said I had a visitor. They put cuffs on me and took me to this office, and there was my dad. You know, last person I wanted to see was my dad. We hadn't uttered a word to each other in a number of years. If I called home, he handed the phone to my mother. There was so much pain between me and my dad, emotional pain. You could feel it. And nobody wanted to be in the same room at the same time. And there was my dad trying to get daughter number two out of a jam. And I don't remember that day much. I asked him a few years ago what I said, and he said, "You told me you weren't guilty." You know, not my fault, you know. I was really falling into that victim role with my alcoholism. I mean, when I lived in New Orleans and I walked into my favorite bar and they had my rock glass full of Jose Cuervo gold sitting out there, and my piano player was playing my song, which was "You Made Me Love You." You know, that's a wonderful role for a victim. I had it made. I just walked right into the bar and that was it. You know, there was my life. I thought I had it made. And he went home that day, hired this attorney, ended up paying a big fine. We found New Orleans. The carnival left town. Of course, nobody came back to look me up. And there I was with this guy and the skunk and the dog, and now we acquired a snake. And we're living on Bourbon Street, and he goes off and works tugboats, but he's got this heroin habit. So, you know, I never understood anybody face down going, "Let's party." We just didn't, you know, quite hit it off. And he'd come home at odd hours, and I remember living above the Mousetrap Bar. I just got to walk by where that place is. And on Lower St. Philip, it was a tar paper roof apartment. And, you know, the bikers would come upstairs to watch us for entertainment sometimes. And, my friend, Captain Gill, was in town. He had one arm, and he sang To Have and Have Not. And he was just kind of a romantic, good, fun guy to be with and party with. And, you know, I'd gotten off early from dancing at the piano bar, and, we were partying. We were just having a good time. And he came home from the tugboats early because he had broken his leg. He had hung it over the side. He got mashed between something. And so there he is with a broken leg and trying to fight the guy with one arm. And, you know, the skunk is running its snark circles. I don't know where the snake is. The dog is barking. And this was just my reality, you know. It was just the way I lived my life. And, you know, if you would have told that little girl in Iowa this is the path she was going to have to take, I think I would have, you know, drowned myself. I had no idea that this was going to be my life, and it was natural for me to live like this. It was absolutely natural for me to live like this. Alcoholism stripped me of any of those. I couldn't stand to have a human feeling. It just hurt too much to care about anything. And so I hung around people that didn't care very much. You know, there were loving and kind people that were there around me. And they were the ones that were trying to take care of me as I was passing out in my own vomit or between a car and a curb. Or the taxi driver would say, I took you home, you owe me, you know, a couple days ago. And, you know, I'd come passed out half in and half out my door not knowing if I'm coming or going. And I started tending bar. I got fired from some of the nice places. I started working local joints. I ended up on Lower Decatur Street, which isn't pretty. You know, it's still not pretty. And, last Monday, Casey and I were there, and I kept looking for this place. I asked a few people, like, where was the Seven Seas, you know? It was the kind of bar where a friend of mine was killed sitting next to the wrong guy. The bullet was meant for him. You know, it's like really a good place. And these people didn't know the Seven Seas. I guess it had been too many years. You know, I felt like a survivor from some horrible disease, you know, the only one left. But we walked and we walked and we found this corner. I said, I think it was here where I worked, the last place I worked that I got fired for having a bad attitude. You know, you could smell the bathroom when you walked by the door. You know, even my local friends didn't want to come party with me there. And, you know, we just held each other. And it was like, whew, seconds and inches, as Norm would say, you know, that we are survivors from the shipwreck, you know, absolutely, you know, and I feel that, and I sense that, and I'm aboard for it, and I'm so, it's not even, it's past the word grateful, you know. My life is your life, because I know I'd be picture of my parents' piano framed in black. You know, yeah, Sharon, she was great. We loved her. She had a lot of potential, made us laugh. Don't know what happened. And Alcoholics Anonymous has allowed my mother to sleep at night, you know. And I still call her every Thanksgiving and ask her how to stuff a turkey without marijuana stuffing. So we still have a laugh or two, but she's real grateful that she knows where her daughter is at night. And 1975 was that kind of year, and my parents had come to visit me at one point, saw this guy, saw the black guy, went home. I sat at that bar, and alcohol didn't work for me that day. It didn't shut off the feelings. It didn't make it okay. It didn't say, screw him. It didn't let me shake my fist. I knew what I was, and I knew it was over. And alcohol was going to do that periodically. It was going to betray me. I started having DTs. I didn't know what they were until I had a boss that taught me about that, a bartender who is still doing well, actually. I don't think he's an alcoholic, but he taught me how to drink through that and how to have that fresh alcohol in my system. I didn't know about that. I just knew I had a drink. I would come to 4 days in a blackout in Florida, or I would have moved to St. Louis in the middle of the night looking for that wonderful boyfriend whose parole found him and moved him back to St. Louis, and should have left that one alone, but I had to go find him and make sure it was over, you know. As he got off the Harley and pulled my head through the window, he had just broken and spit in my face, said, if I ever see you again, I'll kill you, as the police car pulled up, or it would have gotten messier. And that's the way I let go. I said, it's over now, okay, you know. And I had this wonderful sponsor named Jenny for about 5 years of my sobriety. She said, you know, when I hear that story, Sharon, you remind me of this woman who walks around that was in our group, you know, a lot of years ago, and she just would walk around with her fist something in her fist. She would put it in her pocket, and it'd be in her pocket, and then she would take it out and hold it in her fist. And one day we coerced her into opening her little fist to see what was in there, and it was a turd. It was an old, dried-up turd, you know. And I said, gee, thanks a lot, you know. Remind you of this story. Thank you. And, you know, but I told her, you know, with every bit of pride I could muster, you know, and I meant it. I said, I know, but it was my turd, you know. It belonged to me, and that's the way I would hang on to things in my life that were killing me. I had no choice. It was like the dying. And that's what this relationship was like with this guy. And, you know, he's still alive, and he's still raising skunks, and he's still in denial. And he goes to R&R, I think, is what he said. And, you know, I'm glad that I'm on the path I'm on. And I ended up in 1975 walking over my friend Michael's body, who had been shot and killed on Mardi Gras Day. And I was in a blackout, and I know we were partying, and I knew he had a gun, but it was like I didn't take it seriously. Oh, Michael, put it away. It's Mardi Gras Day, you know. And he was shooting at people off my balcony, and I guess the police were called and, you know, leveled the gun, and the policeman shot him, and Michael was one of us, and Michael didn't get here. You know, Michael is on somebody's piano, maybe, in a picture framed in black. You know, and I really do, you know, feel like that there's many, many people that, and many spirits that stand with me in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, as with all of us. You know, alcoholism touches so many lives. And every single time an alcoholic goes out there and has a bender, you know, it touches a lot of lives. And so does our sobriety. So does our sobriety. And if I stay sober till the day I take my last breath, I will never be able to repay Alcoholics Anonymous back for what it's given me. And, you know, I ran a lot, and I ended up in New York and California and New Orleans and back to New York on my way to California, I'm sorry, and ended up in Barney's Beanery. And, they closed the bar at 2. I didn't get that. You know, it's like I hadn't been in a town that had hours. I found, you know, how to get alcohol after 2. I was unemployable. They asked me to leave after 10 minutes as a cocktail waitress. I was 170-plus pounds. I wore a red dashiki and a Panama hat. And I didn't have a place to live, and I didn't have any money, and I was always in the bar drinking or somewhere drinking. And, you know, I lived in this girl's apartment for a while. She was moving out, and she let me live there. Her name was Chris. And, you know, I would go into like a blackout of a day, and I'd come to, and there would be all the furniture gone, you know, and I never knew what delusion I was in or out of, and I'd have to wait for the sun to go down to sneak to that liquor store. You know, there was a time when I couldn't go out if the sun was up. And, you know, Chris was the first time I ever saw the Big Book. I remember she had that book, Came to Believe, with the little seedling that came out of the snow. It used to be the cover. And I was real drunk one night, and I remember crawling over to a bookcase and pulling that book out. And I had no idea. I forgot this story for years, that I had found that book and had read some of it and passed out on that book. And Chris had a Big Book, and she was in the bar going to A&A one day, Barney's Beanery, and they had to call her a taxi cab. She was too drunk to drive. And we all took our drinks and gave her a toast and thought, good for you, Chris, going to A&A. And that's what I knew about A&A. You know, I had no idea that she was going to be my Eskimo in Alcoholics Anonymous. I had no idea that she was going to be in my life and alive long enough to bring me to Alcoholics Anonymous, because she died at 31. She never got the program. She didn't get it. She was in and out and used up whatever it was for her to have. And she died, a very old woman at 31. And I ended up going to Palm Springs because somebody said, let's go, let's party. And, you know, I'm a woman without an address. I don't care. And so I went to Palm Springs with these guys, and they didn't want to party with me. They just wanted extra weight for the back tire, and they had looked around the bar and got the fattest one. It was windy that night, so they needed some weight. So thanks a lot. See ya. And they drove away, and I met 2 more guys and don't remember much about the evening. And, you know, I ended up in a bar with these people, and then I ended up coming to an apartment with these people, and I didn't know who they were, and I wasn't having a DT because it hurt, and they started breaking my face and physically abusing me. And, you know, at some point in the evening, I do remember just stopping screaming, thinking, who the hell cares anyway, and that was my surrender. You know, Norm used to talk about having the screws down on you and laying on the pavement and looking up with them, with every bit of hate you've got, looking up at those people and never saying, you know, you surrender ever. And that's the way I was in my life. And that night I just stopped screaming, who the hell cares anyway? And that was a window of opportunity for me to be maybe willing and teachable to get anything in my life other than my self-centered alcoholic death march, which is what I was on. And after I was found, you know, I heard a voice. The voice said, get up, I want to live. I was at the bottom of a little cliff off a road with bleeding from my face. And I ended up by a pool, and the gardener found me. They didn't know I was a Caucasian. I was so bruised. I ended up in the hospital on a gurney, and I heard that voice again. The voice said, you know, your dad didn't put you here. Neither did these guys. Your sister, the Mensa. George, who broke your heart at 18, that Catholic church, you know. Went through my list of excuses, and it said, you did this to you. And I heard it, you know. And then I went into surgery and was in the hospital for 2 weeks, and nobody sent me an airline ticket. Nobody sent me money. My God was working in my life. And I got out and lived above a liquor store in West L.A. because some guy had heard about what had happened to me, felt sorry for me, and I had this wired jaw. I'm on a liquid diet, and he's buying me cheap red wine, going off to work, and I'd stick a straw on the top of the wine, stick a straw through the wires on the mouth where the tooth had been, and I would suck on this red wine, and there's no more fun in it. Let's not go start over in Arizona or hitchhike over, you know, San Francisco. It was over. And he said I had to leave, that I was depressing him and hurt my pride a little bit. And I called my mother, and my mother had gotten a phone call from somebody in that hospital, and then she had heard 2 days later, they found me, that I was okay. But it took my mother 2 days to find me in a hospital. And my mother has never been to Al-Anon, and she has her own spiritual life, and she said words to me that changed my life. She says, Sharon, I can't help you anymore. Why didn't you go to the Salvation Army? No, I can't send you $20. She would have sent $20, you'd have another speaker. And I called that girl, Chris, because her number was there, and little did I know she was going to go to work on me right away. She was sober that day, you know. She had Suzanne come get me because, you know, she wasn't really in Alcoholics Anonymous, but she was sober enough to get my phone call and to have some woman in Alcoholics Anonymous be at the end of the phone that I called. I didn't know who I was calling. I had no idea I was calling a member of ANA. You know, if I would have known, I might not have called. I just called Suzanne. Suzanne said, put down your drink and put down your joint. And I thought, how does she know I have both? She got my attention. And I sat on the steps of that liquor store, and about weekly I get to drive by the Duck Pond liquor store. I get to look at those steps, and I get to remember how I felt with my broken shoes and my broken jeans and my broken jaw and my broken nose and my broken spirit, sitting on those steps waiting for whoever was coming to get me and wherever we're going. That's what it was, whoever, whatever. And these two beautiful girls got out of a car. I think Suzanne picked her two prettiest babies to come get me. I really think she did. And immediately I thought, no, I'm not going with them anywhere. But they kind of pulled me by the arms and stuck me in the back of this Volkswagen, and off we went to this church, and it took forever to get there, and they're talking about themselves all the time. You know, every red light, they're around the corner telling me about themselves, and I thought, they're very selfish. Nobody once has asked me about me, you know. I had this newspaper clipping. From the Palm Springs paper, I just kept it in my pocket till it practically disintegrated. Nobody in Alcoholics Anonymous said, what happened to you? You know, they were like, oh God, maybe she'll make it. You know, she looks pretty surrendered. You know, they were really happy. You know, I go to this church and a man at the door standing there, his name is John, you know, and I get to see him in my home group. And remember, he was the man standing at the door like your greeter tonight. He had a tie and he looked nice, and I thought he was going to say, oh, please go in the kitchen until you can clean up. He didn't. He said, welcome. And they put me in the front, and I got all this attention. I guess, you know, they figured out I was the newcomer in the room. And you could smell me. You know, I was detoxing. I don't know when I stopped bathing, but there was some point where water started to hurt in the shower. I remember that. I don't know when that left me. But, you know, now that there is not a lot of those funding into a lot of programs for alcoholics, I think it's going to start happening more. You're going to start smelling that detoxing in the room a little bit more. My friend Sean said, start walking around with your wooden spoon. There's going to be some seizures happening. You know, he's excited. He's got it in his pocket, ready to go. And, you know, that smell to me is like Tiffany perfume when I smell that detoxing. Where's the newcomer? Let me look in their eyes. Let me see how much fun it is, you know. I just love being right next to it, you know, and knowing that the miracle is right here because, you know, something happens when you get to work with others, when you get to watch others. If you don't have babies, adopt one. They don't have to know that you're adopting them, but just watch them, ask them about their life, pick them up occasionally, and wait for the night they walk into the room with that different look in their eyes. And you go, wow, I got to be a part of watching that happen. It's an inside little light switch that goes on, you know. It's so special. You think, oh, they shaved their mustache, did something different to their hair. Maybe it's that red they're wearing. No, and then you look in their eyes and there's somebody home. And it's so amazing to be around that. You know, I'm so excited when I watch people come into Alcoholics Anonymous and I watch their lives change because it gives me hope. And that's something I had nothing of when I came to you. I had no hope. Hope was gone. You know, hope was somebody I met in a bar and that was it. You know, I had the big fight and no more. And I sat in Alcoholics Anonymous for a long time before I realized really what I was doing here and what it was all about. There's sponsors that said, take her home and wait for the liquor store lights to turn off before you send her upstairs, and that's love, because they had to sit with me for a couple hours in the car. They would take me out to coffee shops. I had this wire job for 3 months, and I couldn't talk. I had learned to listen, you know, and I had no control over one side of my face, and occasionally, I mean, you know, without missing a beat, they just lean over and dab it up, you know, as the coffee's kind of pouring out the right side of my mouth, you know. And that's love, you know. It wasn't like, oh, I'm her keeper. It was like, come on, you know. They just brought me along, and the old-timers in my group were just, you know, they were teaching their babies how to work with somebody. So they were hoping I was going to make it, but they were hoping they didn't have to get too involved. And so I was working with a lot of people in their first five, working on their first five steps, different stages, you know. It was always very dramatic, you know, and I had this borrowed sleeping bag and this big book I gave Maurice my last quarter for, and I paid him back, too. I wasn't going to owe him anything, you know. I paid him back. It took me months to pay that man for that big book, but I didn't want to owe you anything because I'm only here for a little while. And Penny was talking about cookies. We're going to have cookies and milk on Penny later, and she reminded me of that commitment of Junan, this woman who, you know, her son's sober, her daughter's sober, and I'm sober, and she never made it, you know. But she would drag me around. I was a mess. I didn't look very good, and she loved to take me to Rodeo and some of those really cushy meetings and stand me by the coffee pot to shake hands with everybody. And she would stand in the corner and just grin, you know. But she had this commitment at this meeting of cookies. I was cup washer because I was good at that. And she dropped me off and she'd go get the cookies and come back. And she didn't come back one night. It was like, where's Junan? You know, the meeting's going to start. And if you want to have an important commitment, do cookies. I mean, everybody, you know, knows when the cookie person isn't there. It's like a very powerful commitment. I remember when I had it, if I didn't like that old timer, he'd make me mad. He wouldn't get Oreos for 2 or 3 weeks. You know, I didn't buy him his Oreos, you know. So Junan went out to get the cookies and come back, and all of a sudden this cop car pulls up, and we're going, okay, he's got a bag, and he's walking up, and it's a bag of cookies. And we said, what's going on? He said, well, Junan's in the car. She, you know, bought the cookies with the money, but then shoplifted some candy bars, but she convinced me to bring these cookies to you guys. So I got to take her in, but here's your cookies. And now, Junan taught me about commitment. No matter what, you show up, you make sure those cookies are there, the coffee's on, the literature's out, no matter what, you know. And God bless Junan. I got to go back to Atlanta about 4 years ago, and I found her living behind a mansion in with a pet rooster. And the bottles were put away that day, and the pictures were out. She was dying of alcoholism and cancer, and I got to tell her, thank you. You know, and because that Christmas card came back deceased that year. And, you know, she's another one in my life that's right there in my pocket with me, is that woman. I'll never forget what she did for me. Absolutely will not forget. And, you know, I had sponsors that were mean. Janet was half Mexican, half Indian, and mean. And fluorescent. She was fluorescent. She was, after I kind of came to and realized this woman was wearing a chartreuse bow and pink socks and yellow hot pants and this little tube top, I was like, oh my God, you know. And she was tiny, so I could like always look for her feet. I could always find her in a room, you know. She was kind of sparkled, and she had this laugh like a duck, and I would go, oh God, you know. She'd quack, 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 you know, louder than everybody. And One night she wasn't at that meeting. She was supposed to be there so I could share this big breakthrough I had that day with her. And she was, you know, probably home watching TV with him, you know. And I'm in the front row with my arms folded. And I hear from the back of the room through the main speaker, I hear quack, 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 you know. And I just felt safe. There was a feeling of, oh, good, she's here, that I hadn't felt in so long. And things like that began to slowly come back to me, those feelings of, because I was around you, I was with you, it was happening all around me. I was part of it. I was showing up. My mind was really not my friend. It's still not my friend. I remember Janet had me lock it in the trunk of my car when I would go to my first job. She said, take your mind out, lock it in the trunk. Okay, I'd take it out, and I'd lock it in my trunk, and she said, when you punch out, you can go get it, you know? Then I would go get my mind, put it in my head, and we'd go off to a meeting, and then they'd all start again, you know? But my mind is not my friend to this day, and I'm so glad I learned that. You know, my feet are my friend. My feet get me to where I'm supposed to go, even today. I don't listen to my mind. I watch my feet. I manicure my feet. I rub my feet. I love my feet, you know? My mind still sits on the edge of the bed like a big vulture and waits for me to wake up many mornings, you know, and it's been fed and it's ready, you know, and I just got to take a pass on it, you know, and go do what I'm supposed to do, because I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous it's action that leads my way into good living. It's the actions, you know, it's not my thinking. And there is no chapter into thinking, you know. I've heard that said so much. It's so true. And, you know, Janet was so good for me. She was louder than my head. She'd get in my face. She'd make me do things. We did that third step. She was very happy. She hugged me for a long time. It felt good. I thought I was gay. You know, it was like a whole... I had no idea what was going on in my life. You know, I was sober and Alcoholics Anonymous, and these feelings would just be like comets shooting across, you know, like trails. And, oh, every once in a while I get a real feeling. Every once in a while something would click. It's like an old computer being put together wire by wire by wire. And every once in a while I would have this big breakthrough, and I had a sponsor to share it with, you know. And she made me go to work, and we started being part of the force for good, you know. We started working our program when people weren't looking. You know, people would ask how I was on my job. I was a waitress. I was a service person. You know, I had to stop telling them how I was. You know, people stopped giving me tips and sitting in my station. You know, she said, just go say fine, thank you. Give them an Al-Anon smile. We worked on that a long time. And my tips got better. My life got better. I got better waitress jobs, you know. I remember the night I got my car painted. I picked it up from Earl Shy, Basin Street Blue. I should have known. It was a New Orleans color, and I was going to drink over that. I said, that's not my car. Not my car. It's too bright, you know. It's like, that's not my car. And, you know, there was the bar, and there was the payphone, and I ended up at the payphone, and she didn't laugh at me, and she didn't say, oh, that's stupid. She, you know, we laughed about it. We eventually laughed about it. I began to trust her with these silly feelings, and I began to trust her with more intimate things. I did a fourth step because she goaded me into it. She made me mad. She made me more angry than I was afraid. And I ended up writing that fourth step at the airport, and I write every fourth step at the airport. And that's just where I do it. It just works for me. I have to feel like I'm going somewhere and nobody will ever read this, you know. And that's what I do. I write my fourth steps at the airport, and I take my fifth steps with my sponsor. And I have taken many fifth steps, and I'm always amazed at the other layer I can get to, you know, with your help, and able to see and able to have more work to do. I know God isn't done with me yet. I've got a long ways to go. I'm 21 years and 17 days sober, and I feel like I'm just beginning. The excitement I feel for Alcoholics Anonymous is vibrant and alive in me, you know, and that's because I'm involved. That's because I'm part, right next, standing next to the miracle. Almost every day of my life, I get to just rub on a miracle, which is God working in our lives, because we should be not here. We should be somewhere else. We should be dying or dead. And he has given us a second chance to be here and to be with each other and to know when we say that Lord's Prayer that we are just part of the link in the chain of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I want to be a strong one. I want to be there for you if you need me, because you've been there for me and I have needed you over my 21 years many times. I've gotten... you know, boy meets girl on AA campus. You know, we all have those stories. And and he had 6 more months than me, and he was very, you know, it was exciting. He had 27 and a half tattoos, and I liked that story about the half a tattoo. It was a good one. And I took him home to meet Mom and Dad, and we're 1 year sober, and I'm supposed to make my amends to my father, and you know, they were glad he was sober and had a job, and he wasn't calling me four-letter words, and he was polite, and, you know, like my mom's cooking, and, you know, it was, you know, Sharon's in that AA thing, they would whisper, you know, for a number of years, you know, they didn't understand it, they didn't know it. And now my dad walks down the street and stops people. You know, my daughter went to New Zealand to speak for Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, it's like, Dad, there's something called anonymity, you know, and... And he's just proud of what you've done with me, you know. He's absolutely proud of what you've done with me. And he's 78 years old, so he can get away with it, you know, a doddering fool, you know. And, but I went home, and I went home specifically to make amends to my dad. And it was rough, you know. They were putting the bags in the car, and we're going to catch the plane. And I came home to make amends. It's the last hour here in Iowa, and my sponsor will get her finger in my face if I don't do what I'm supposed to do. And so I stood by the car, and my dad stood by the car, and I remember we just kind of played in the sand with our toes, you know, and I said what I had to say to him looking at my toes, and he said what he had to say to me looking at his toes, and he just always wanted me to be happy, and there was no hugs, there were no big sparks, it was no huge healing, it was, okay, it's done, now we can move a little bit further ahead, and it was still real tense between me and my dad for a long time. He came out for my wedding, I was 2.5 years sober, and we had an Alcoholics Anonymous wedding, and it was two ex-Catholics, a Baptist minister, a day at a time putting the vows. We sobered up a rock and roll band. A couple of them are still sober to this day, so they could play at the wedding. And Mack the Knife was the wedding song because they didn't play anything for me and my dad to dance to, so Mack the Knife became the wedding song. And at the end of the day, he looked at me and he said, Sharon, look at your life. You've got it made. If you think about doing what you're doing before, think twice. And I thought, okay, the big quake is coming right now. Dad has just given me his approval, you know. And I looked at him and said, yeah, you're right, Dad, because I believed in what we were doing here. I believed in myself a little bit more because of working the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had done some things that were very hard for me, which was open that door, you know, the doorknob's on the inside, and you can beat on it all you want until I take my hand around that doorknob, take my other hand and hold onto the wrist and turn it a little bit and let you see inside of me, did I start to get better? And that sponsor did that for me because she never judged me. And I trusted her and she didn't ever hurt me. And Janet was so good for me for 4 years. And then Ginny walked into my life, and Ginny was a full-fledged woman with flamboyance and style. And I thought, you know what? I think it's time I can be a woman now. And she taught me how. And my husband was happy because we were married, you know. He was happy I was becoming more of a woman because I was just so afraid I couldn't cut it. And she taught me how to be a woman, and she taught me a lot of fun things. And we, you know, one night I was with her on the phone, and we were talking about parents, and, you know, I had probably just gotten a letter from my mom. She said, well, how's your relationship with your dad? And I said, it's still tense, you know. She said, why don't you pay him back the money you owe him? I said, well, how do you know about that money and the car and the credit cards and the bail bondsman and the lawyer? And she, you know, she said, why don't you call him up and ask him how much you owe? I mean, let's start making those a financial amends to your father. And so I called him up, and he didn't say, I'll get back to you. He said, it's this much. You know? He had come to AA when he was at my wedding. Bought the big book. He's a reader, you know. He put the calculator tape right there on page 78 where it says, alcoholics owe money. I'm most alcohol. If I'm not home, Sharon calls, give her the bottom line, you know. And she will call if she gets to this point of the book. So I called her back, and I said it was too high and he was too fast. And she said very lovingly she didn't care. And so we talked about the terms, and I called him back, and he accepted my terms and didn't amend anything. And so I called her, and she said, okay, then, you know, you may be the only example of that big book your father ever sees, you know, and I respect that. I respect the examples in Alcoholics Anonymous, the people that walk through the good, the people that walk through the bad, and never leave, the ones that come back and tell me about it every night, never leave. I respect the examples. I respect the old-timers. And I listened to her, and I was not late with that check to my father. And she had me do something a little bit more than what I would have done, which was write a note about my life and put it with the check. A letter with the check. You know, and he's got three other professional children. Successful. They named an airplane after my sister, you know. I saw it first, though. She didn't see it. I saw it first, took pictures, stood by it, you know. That felt good. That's the Mensa, that one. Oh. But I did it anyway, because she monitored me and she loved me, and I didn't want to disappoint her, and I didn't want her to be on my case. And I am not that big all the time to know I'm doing a spiritual act. I need people with me, pushing me, guiding me, beside me, giving me the strength when I don't have it. And that's what my sponsors have always done for me. They are louder than my head, and I believe in them. They are down the path, and I believe in them. And so I did this to my father for 3.5 years. 3 3/4 years, actually. And there were many months I didn't have it, and I remember calling her once saying, "Jenny, I don't have it this month." And she said, "Oh, Sharon, he's putting it into a trust fund for you. You can't save money. You know, you can buy your Jaguar when this is all over." Well, I sent it early for about 3 months after that, you know. It's like so excited about this trust fund. And she's smart. They go to sponsor school, you know. And my father picked up the phone between Christmas and New Year's after doing this check and this note and these letters, and it turned into cards. And, you know, it was easy to write that letter to my dad after a while. I didn't even notice the transition. And he picked up the phone, dialed my number, called me, and said, "Merry Christmas, no more checks, no more money. Your debt with me is free and clear. I got off light." And he added the words that made the difference, which are, "Don't stop sending me your notes." And my dad and I got to walk into a guilt-free, brand-new relationship because of Alcoholics Anonymous. Not because I'm a good person, but because of the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, the powerful amend steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I got to hold my head up a little bit higher with the male population after that. My friends in New Orleans, I got to go back to the International Convention in New Orleans, and I got to try to 12-step people, and they don't even remember it, much of them. And but the word was back that I was back in town. You should see what Alcoholics Anonymous has done with her. Just the physical changes, people didn't recognize me. And Danny is sober 12 and a half years, and Robin is sober 12 and a half years, and they were my best friends. And many of the people we drank with are dead and gone, or with a walker, or liver cancer. And, you know, Danny went back to law school, and a few years ago she sent me this piece of paper that showed that I was a full pardoned ex-felon from the state of Louisiana. And I stood up a little straighter and taller that day, too. And, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous has afforded me to become a whole human being. I don't know when it happened, but I do remember taking my 7th birthday cake and feeling whole for the first time in my life. I didn't feel that piece of slate in my gut that was holding the feelings back. From the tip of my head to the tip of my toes, I felt like God's kid. And I knew what Chuck C. meant. I knew what he meant. He'd talk over my head all the time. I had no idea what that man was talking about, but I knew what he meant about being God's kid. You had cleaned me out, and you had helped me stand up in my own skin and become one of many, and I felt it. And I wanted more of that, and I got real hooked on it. And if I had to do it involved and sponsor people and work with others and show up on those 12-step calls, and it's not a lot to ask to give somebody a ride. It's not a lot to ask to show a little bit of kindness at a meeting. It's not a lot to ask for what you've given me. And if I can have that attitude every morning of my life, I have a great day, you know. It's when I let that little old lady cut me off, and I'm going to show her she shouldn't be on the road during rush hour traffic, you know, that I forget my purpose here, you know, which is to be of service to God and the people about me, you know. It's, you know, the little old lady has a great day, and I'm frothing at the mouth, you know, and my life has gotten really good. I went through a terrible divorce at 10 years of sobriety. He picked a newcomer, and she wasn't, I didn't think she was very cute, and I thought she was kind of chubby, and we had this baby in 1984. I had gotten these great jobs. I was able to semi-retire for one and get some 401k money, and I was being a mom and a housewife and sponsoring people, and then there he ruins it, you know, and I had to, you know, my sponsor, 21 years, started smoking pot and came back from Paris and gave up her time. And she's got, I think it's October or November, she'll have a year. And she's been trying for a long time. You know, I watched someone with a lot of time try to get back to Alcoholics Anonymous that I love dearly, and I watched the light go out. And I watched her do time around here, you know, like you're doing prison time. And I thought, you know, and thank God the light is a little bit on now. I'm watching it come back on. But Clancy became my sponsor, and I told him, you know, "I don't like you much, and I don't think you like me much, but I need you right now." And he said, "Come in and sit down." And I brought my baby in his house, and I sat down. And he was kind to me. And I was lost. I was absolutely. I remember I came to Sacramento to speak, and I brought newcomers with me, and they wanted to go to the bathroom about Bakersfield, and I said, "No, we're going to speak at an AA meeting. Shut up!" You know, I was just like this mad woman at 10 years of sobriety. And my friend Pat walked by me and said, "Look at Sharon. She's got 10 years. Do you want what she's got?" And she walked by, and God, I hurt her. You know, I had cut my hair and spiked it all up, and I was, like, angry, walking around with my arms folded all the time, and there they are having a good time, and now they're going to get married, and, you know, I never prayed for them to get drunk, but I prayed for a lot of other things, you know, and one night they're in the, it was a room about this size, I had tables, and my sponsor always speaks, and he was there on a Saturday night, and I had 2 big cups of hot coffee. I was on my way to see how spiritual they were having too much fun. And he saw that look in my eyes, and he saw the trajectory, and he stopped me, took the coffee, put them on the table, grabbed me by the shoulders, very gently looked in my eyes, said, "You will walk through this with dignity and grace." And I didn't care about dignity and grace at the time, but he added the words, "So you can be an example to others," and I heard him. And I gave up, I started working my steps, and I started getting better, and then their baby, they had a baby boy, I thought, oh God, you know. My son was so happy, he's got this little brother, and it's like, why couldn't she have a girl? Why'd she have to have a boy? And I had to give her some of his clothes as he'd outgrow them, and, you know, and she was nice to him when he'd go to her house, and my son wanted to go to his brother's first birthday party, and I just, my sponsor said, "Show up with a gift. Bring your kid." I bought a present. I remember it was on sale. Sat in that car, and I walked up to their condo, and I knocked on the door, and they were expecting me, and I came in, and they had a great little party, and you know how one-year-olds are. He was so happy his brother would put his face in the cake, and my son was just so elated, and he had this little, maybe he had his little Ghostbuster little thing on, and you know, and because they had took a video of this, you know, there I am, and one of the pictures kind of, you know, like this, trying, I was in the kitchen the whole time, washing and cleaning, and but I got through it, you know, and she was nice to me, and I started to like her, and we started to do things with the kids together, and I thought, you know, she's not so bad, and, you know, we started to do things like take the kids skiing, you know, and it was a good time, and, you know, this last week ago Monday, she gave me a 21-year cake at my women's meeting, and she cried. She gave me this cake, and she's not really that emotional of a person. I always kind of respect her because she always kind of could keep it in and be strong. And she cried when she gave me this birthday cake. And, you know, we've been better friends now that they've been divorced a few years. But she said, you know, when he left her for somebody else, watch how you get him, that I was her example of walking through it with dignity and grace. It's none of my business why I'm doing this. It's none of my business why I'm in the hallway growing. You know, I whine. It's just called growth, sharing, get over it. It's life, you know. And there's always a beautiful view when that new door opens. Always. More pretty than the one I left. And Alcoholics Anonymous just keeps getting deeper and better and sweeter. And I have never been disappointed here. I am the kind of alcoholic who wants more. And sober, I'm like that. I want more of that inside feeling. And I get it every time I walk through a little bit of a hallway. And it's none of my business who's supposed to watch or who I'm the example for. I may never know, but it's none of my business. I am supposed to walk through that with dignity and grace, whatever it is, and be an example of Alcoholics Anonymous. And today, my son had a big event in his life, and it was something that he's working for, and I'm very proud of him. And he had, you know, he rollerbladed the windshields this morning, got the donuts, and in my house today was my son, his little best friend, his little brother, my ex, his wife, who's an Al-Anon, and they're fine. We're glad. Her kid, my mate, and me, and I had to choke back the tears. Only because of Alcoholics Anonymous was this all able to happen, the joy in my son's life and the people there celebrating it. And the feeling in the room was not of watching each other, wondering what's going to happen. It was a feeling of camaraderie. It was like survivors from a shipwreck. Every single one of us was grateful to sit there and breathe and sit next to each other. And, you know, I used to think that freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose. Boy, I live by that. And I found out in Alcoholics Anonymous that I was dead a long time and I was not free. And I came to you, and it talks about it on page 25, this simple set of spiritual tools which you laid at my feet. And you showed me how to work them and said, you got to do the work. We can show you how. We've been there, and I knew you'd been there. And that's freedom to me, is the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. A God that is bigger than I'll ever, ever need, and rubbing on the miracle every day of my life by being with you. I want to thank you for having me tonight, and I want to thank you for your God.